It is, as we do every Friday in the 4 o'clock hour, the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. And my experts today are Alan Paller of the Sands Institute. Great to see you as always, my friend.
Good to be here, Francis.
And Ron Sanders of Booz Allen, also a friend, and glad you're here today as well.
Glad to be here, Francis.
And I want to get a quick plug in because we are quickly coming up on the fourth anniversary of the Federal News Countdown, one of the longest-running features on Federal News Radio. The first program in January 14 of 2014 will be the fourth anniversary of the show. Pretty cool. I had no idea anybody would pay any attention when we started it over 3 years ago.
And you're going to have all your regulars on at once?
and it's going to be like a 12-hour show. All of the people who are on the countdown over the past 4 years.
That'll attract listeners.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that'll, we can do a countdown marathon. And count, or we should do like they do on rock radio, where they count down like the top 500 songs of the year, and do that. That would go over real big, I'm sure. Well, you gentlemen have each chosen the three most important federal news stories of the week in your view, and we'll start where we always do with
number three.
Alan Paller, your third most important story is Jason Miller's from FederalNewsRadio.com. The headline is NIST's cyber framework moves toward implementation stage. NIST has been at this for a while, and so this is good news that they are getting ready to do something that people can start to use.
It's a big story, and it has drawn grave responses from industry saying the government is asking for too much, and responses from other people on the other side. What's fascinating about it, and this is something that John Pescatore said in Newsbyte, say John used to run cybersecurity for Gartner, there's nothing new here. It is just NIST guidance with a little cover on it. It literally isn't anything but pablum plus some NIST guidance. And the reason it matters isn't the fight. It's a quick story, if you don't mind. There's a state auditor. He'll come out publicly in a few weeks, but I won't mention his state or his name right now. But he's the auditor of the state. Because they do a lot of federal work, they thought themselves to be subject to NIST guidance. So he was in charge of enforcing NIST guidance for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then the governor made him the chief security officer. And the first thing he did was check to see how good the security was. Mm-hmm. And in just a very short time, just a few days, the penetration testers had taken complete control of seven of the state systems, including millions of records of people within the state. And he went back to see what mistake he had made, because he felt it was his fault. And what he learned was that the NIST guidance was impossible to implement. Mm-hmm. No one had enough money. Mm-hmm. And what he decided to do was to focus on a small number of controls that actually protected the state. And he's got great data coming out. But that's why it's such a big story, because we're making a lot of noise about the NIST guidance, and there's nothing there. It's the emperor's new clothes.
The story's on federalnewsradio.com. When will we see something that people then can do something with, if this isn't quite it yet?
I think we're going to see it from some of the work that Tony Sager from NSA and Jane Hole Loot, who was the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security, are doing. We'll talk about that in the next story, actually, because it started this week in Seoul, or last week in Seoul, with 1,600 people in 80 nations.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Alan Powers from FederalNewsRadio.com. NIST's cyber framework moves toward implementation stage. Ron, your third most important story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is, despite government shutdown, federal job seekers bombard agencies with applications. That's heartening, I suppose, because it appears that morale is better among people who want to work for the government than it is for people who actually work for the government today.
Well, I chose three stories, sort of good news, bad news, and then what do we do about the both? Mm-hmm. And the good news story is, as you've suggested, folks outside government want in. And, you know, despite all of the press, frankly, the help wanted sign is still out. Government attrits 90 to 100,000 people a year, no matter what the conditions. In some years, it's accelerated. My prediction is that we may finally see, maybe not the retirement tsunami, but some pretty big waves. We're already beginning to see that, especially at senior ranks. And there's a daisy chain effect. Those will trickle down and eventually lead to some entry-level hiring and mid-career hiring. But that attrition and attrition-driven hiring is literally across the board. My bad news story, and it relates to Alan's business, we'll get to in a minute. There are pockets where attrition is higher, and that's problematic. But the help wanted sign is out. People still want in. The value proposition for government service, the two parts of it, make a difference, but also relative, underscore that word, relative stability and security. Those are still viable, and frankly, federal agencies ought to take advantage of it and, as you said, be heartened by it.
We thought that maybe we were going to start to see the numbers, see the dam burst last February when OPM predicted about 8,000 retirees or retirement claims and got about 20,000. In March, the numbers kind of went back to normal, and their numbers comported pretty well with what they predicted they were going to be. Does that mean that if we see that extend into March or April of this year, that that might be the predictor that this retirement wave is finally going to happen? Or is there some other dynamic that we can expect?
Well, there is a dynamic there, and wave is a good analogy because it's not steady state throughout the year, obviously. There's always a surge at the end of the year and beginning of the next, and then it tails off a little bit. So there are patterns here. I'm not sure OPM has ever modeled those patterns. I know that, frankly, we have, because one of the things we do is help agencies do workforce planning. And there are all sorts of interesting dynamics like, time of year, the external economy, and a statistic I especially like, propensity to retire. Not everybody retires when they're eligible. And literally, profession by profession, you can see some wait 2 years, some wait 3 years. But all of that, again, drives hiring. So while agencies aren't replacing one for one, they can't not replace anybody. So whether it's one for two or one for four, the fact is help wanted sign is out. And even as government is shrinking, it's still hiring, and so there's plenty of opportunity.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Ron Sanders. It's from the Washington Post. Despite government shutdown, federal job seekers bombard agencies with applications, and you can find that story and all the stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Number two of the week from Alan Paller and from Ron Sanders when we come back on the countdown on Federal News Radio.
Are back on the ice, and you don't want to miss any of the action of this exciting 2013-14 season. Single game tickets are on sale now, so make sure to get yours today.
Ovechkin, he scores! Off the draw! Ovechkin!
Don't miss Ovechkin, Backstrom, Green, and the rest of your Washington Capitals as they take the ice this season. To purchase single game tickets, call 800-745-3000.
Here's Joe Alba, Associate CIO and CISO, Department of Transportation. Continuous monitoring, tools and techniques for trustworthy government IT panel. Sponsored by Tripwire.
What we don't have is situational awareness of what those things do collectively and how that paints a holistic posture of what we're trying to accomplish, which, as technologies change, the framework allows you to bring new technologies in without having to start over from scratch. And that's the important piece of continuous monitoring.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Agencies are under immense pressure to implement continuous monitoring to improve their cybersecurity performance. Tripwire understands cyber threats and vulnerabilities, federal initiatives, and compliance standards. That's why agencies using Tripwire's foundational security controls typically achieve over 80% risk reduction in under 6 quarters. Leading federal agencies and nearly half of the Fortune 500 depend on Tripwire. Find out why at tripwire.com.
Ask the CIO is brought to you by LearningTree International. LearningTree International is the number one provider of IT classroom training to the federal government.
Jason Healy is the director of the Cyber Statecraft Initiative for the Atlantic Council.
We've so fetishized the topic of information sharing, we've lost sight of what decisions and actions need to get taken to get the right things done. And overwhelmingly, those actions and decisions are in the private sector.
Listen to Ask the CIO Thursday mornings at 10:30 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Get empowered with the IT skills you need to improve performance and help your agency achieve its goals. LearningTree is the number one provider of IT classroom training to the federal government, and they're on GSA IT 70 and MOBIS 874 schedules, which means all levels of the government and qualified contractors get the best tuition savings possible. Save even more with LearningTree's 50% off select IT and management courses each week. For 50% tuition savings, go to learningtree.com/CIO. That's learningtree.com/CIO.
Recent and pending legislation, federal budget cuts, strategic sourcing, human capital, and the relationship between government and industry will be discussed at NCMA's upcoming 32nd Annual Government Contract Management Symposium, November 18th and 19th in Washington, D.C. Hear from the Honorable Charles F. Bolden, Jr., NASA Administrator, as well as Kenneth Asbury, President and Chief Executive Officer of CACI, in addition to three leading expert panels. Learn more about this training event at ncmahq.org/WFED.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Ron Sanders and by Alan Paller, and we're up to
number two.
And Alan, your second most important federal news story of the week you alluded to in our last part of our conversation is from Seoul. The headline is Government Officials, Civil Leaders Agree on Online Safety Cooperation. And this is gets to something that you and I have talked about in the past, and that is the United States can do all it wants to about cybersecurity and set whatever standards or whatever it wants to, but if it's not engaged in the international community, it doesn't really mean anything because of the nature of the Internet.
It's exactly right. And this meeting in Seoul was the third of three annual meetings, one in England, one in Helsinki, and or Hungary. I'm not sure, but I would... but this one was in Seoul, and it had 1,600 people, 87 nations, the heads, the top government officials in cybersecurity and communications from many countries. What has happened in the 3 years is that the senior people have gotten tired of just talking about it. So the discussion went from, there's a big threat, we ought to do something about it, this is a common problem, to what comes first? What do we have to do first? And the Australians... really had a breakthrough this year where they discovered that all of the critical attacks against government computers had a kill chain that you could stop with four specific controls. And what came out of this meeting in Seoul, particularly led by Jane Holt, who was the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security and was the chair for cybersecurity for this Seoul conference and used to be at the United Nations, so these are a lot of her friends, she came to the meeting with a sense that we now know what to do, and our job is to do it instead of study it. And she actually got them to change the communique. So it is, we now understand what needs to be done, and it's time to do it. So I think it's the beginning of a shift in cybersecurity from hiring people to do needs assessment and risk analysis to hiring people to actually make the computer safe.
I've stolen the line that you've used many times, which is that we need to shift away from admiring the problem and get to doing something about it. This conference calls people together, and Alan talks about the ability, Ron, to get toward doing something. The biggest problem that we've seen, it's right in your area of expertise, is the people who are able and qualified to do it. Plenty of people, as you talked about in your last story, want to come to work for the federal government. But are they qualified to do it, the jobs that we need them to do? And especially in cyber right now, that's a tremendous problem.
That's the long pole in the tent. Mm-hmm. And it's not just people with IT skills, as Alan far more than I, have said over and over. There's a subset of folks who have this aptitude.
Mm-hmm.
Keith Alexander calls them hunter warriors or something like that. That's the pointy end of the spear when it comes to cybersecurity. And while we're closing the talent gap at a national level, slowly but surely, I worry that the talent gap is actually widening in the federal government.
And we'll talk about that in a minute as we get to your second most important story of the week, Ron. The one note in here that I thought was interesting, Alan, given what we've talked about the global nature of this, This story says some African and South American guests were newly invited to the gathering, which previously focused mainly on European guests, in order to better discuss collaboration between developed and developing countries in the cybersphere. It strikes me that there's a tremendous opportunity because, especially Africa, but South America too, to some extent, is just still in the very nascent stages of becoming involved in the cyber globe or the cyber universe, however we want to look at it. And so it seems to be to everybody's advantage to make sure that they're included early on, because not only are they new to this, but there would seem to be, because they're new to it, a pretty ripe breeding ground for the bad guys to go and set up shop.
Yeah, you've got it exactly right. The countries seem to go through three stages. One is where it's simply an opportunity for people who have a skill to make a lot of money by stealing on the internet. You hear about the African spam problem.
Yes.
And that's real. It's not, they didn't name it that because they wanted a new name. It came from there. And the best story is actually Romania, that went through this phase where it was the home of many, many bad guys. And then Sean Henry went to visit the prime minister and said, they're just going to close the internet to all Romanian traffic if you don't fix it. And the country not only turned around, but became a leader in cybersecurity. So the interest is there. People don't know what to do yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's where Jane Holut's work and the Council on Cybersecurity is so important. They're actually defining what needs to be done first and the skills. So they're doing both the skills definition and the technical definition. I think there's progress.
Now, Alan kind of poo-pooed this idea before we went on the air, but I wanted to offer it to you because I did get, speaking of Africa, I have an opportunity to make a lot of money from a guy in Africa, and all I have to do is send him my routing number, and I'm going to get like $1 million. And I'm very excited about it. And
a coincidence. I, too, have been apprised of that opportunity.
It's amazing the wonderful things that people will do for us these days. Alan Powler's second most important federal news story of the week is from the Yonhap News Agency in South Korea. The headline is Government Officials, Civil Leaders Agree on Online Safety Cooperation. And Ron, your second most important story is in the same vein. It's from NextGov, and the headline is Cyber Civil Servants Knock on Industry's Door After Shutdown. This is, I imagine, not limited just to cyber professionals, but it's especially critical given what we talked about a moment ago about where the federal government's already in bad shape when it comes to the amount of people and the quality of their skills who are working in cyber professions in the federal government, and now this.
Right. Talk about sending a message.
Mm-hmm.
The government's gone through this before. We went through this in the 90s and a little bit in the early 2000s in the civil agencies. Where professionals who happen to have mission-critical skills for whatever reason no longer find government attractive as a career choice, and they vote with their feet. I have to tell you, though, I've been around a long time, since last century, the one constant, the high-demand critical skill that that is always out there and where the government has a difficult time competing has been IT, and as a subset now, cyber. And I found the story especially alarming because these are cyber professionals who aren't just sort of leaving quietly. They're literally out there trying to find private sector jobs and taking their colleagues with them. And I really, really worry about that. There are salary differences. We can overcome salary differences by focusing on mission and making a difference. But when even that's tarnished a bit, as shutdowns are wont to do, then that value proposition becomes harder and harder to realize.
The idea of trying to keep people in government, too, is we've talked about that before, the retention piece being even more difficult than the recruiting piece. You know, your first story was about how the applications keep coming in. We didn't get a chance when we talked about that to dive into the quality of those applications because the sheer volume is not the only important piece. But, Alan, the idea that the very people that we need the most to stay are the people who are first potentially to be out the door should be, I mean, this should be fireworks, bells going off, sirens blaring, shouldn't it?
It's a problem for government, but the consultants offer phenomenal amounts of money. What I've been seeing, though, is that there's uncertainty in leaving government. That part of the value proposition is other than these shutdowns, is it's pretty safe. And if they're given very cool jobs, and cybersecurity can have some very cool jobs, they stay. The ones who seem to leave that I've seen leaving are the ones who are given boring jobs to do. They have the technical skills. They could do extraordinary work, but they're given administrative work or writing reports instead of actually doing cybersecurity. So I think the federal managers – I don't think this is a question of this particular area having a problem. I think it's the management not giving the interesting work to the – to the employees and giving the interesting work to the contractors, because mm-hmm. contractors are excited about it.
Right.
If you give interesting work to the employees, you could build up a staff. I think NSA has done that really well. I think the other agencies haven't done that. They've contracted most of it out.
Well, and it's a vicious circle. I don't know which is the cart and which is the horse, whether that's giving the interesting work to contractors or giving boring work to federal employees and having them vote with their feet. Again, the causal arrow points in both directions. The thing that I worry about, there's so much emphasis on compliance. Whether it's government or contractor, compliance is writing reports and checking off boxes. And I've seen both agencies and contractors hire really, really bright cybersecurity professionals who want to be in the thick of things and do some of the things we've all talked about. And they get stuck writing reports or checking boxes. And that's when you lose them. And I don't care whether it's a contractor or an agency. There are plenty of opportunities for that pointy end of the spear that we talked about. And I'll tag on to Alan's story. The skill set is changing even as we speak, because it's not just the certified ethical hacker with superior technical skills. It's somebody with those skills and analytic and critical thinking skills that I used to call an intelligence analyst. I'm not sure we call it that anymore, but they're able to reason and critique and use logic. And in many cases, they have to have a foreign language skill, because the Internet's no longer the sole domain of, English is no longer the sole language on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a combination of those technical skills, the critical thinking, the analytic skills, the language and regional expertise, in even some of the softer sciences, the social sciences. I think that's becoming the pointy end of the spear, and that's even harder to A, develop, B, motivate, and C, keep. Again, whether you're an agency or a contractor, that's hard, and there are just so many opportunities for somebody with that skill set.
Alan, we only have about a minute left, but are you heartened by the fact that what Ron is talking about is potentially being the biggest detriment to keeping people, the compliance piece? That's supposed to be going away as we go to a continuous monitoring environment where doing the work rather than writing about the work is going to become the standard operating procedure, at least in theory.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, we've seen a substantial decline in employment of people who can write reports but can't do the technical work.
Mm-hmm.
Substantial decline in employment.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Ron Sanders. Is from NextGov. The headline is Cyber Civil Servants Knock on Industry's Door After Shutdown. You can read it and all of our stories from this week's Federal News Countdown when we come back on In-Depth with Francis Rose. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Ron and Alan. We'll do that when we return on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
National Cybersecurity Awareness Month update brought to you by BAE Systems. The National Institute of Standards and Technology is looking for comment on its guidelines for smart grid cybersecurity. The committee behind the framework wants to address various technologies that have become commonplace since the original draft proposal in 2009. Comments are being accepted until December 24th. This National Cybersecurity Awareness Month update brought to you by BAE Systems on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Let's get down to brass tacks. There's nothing more important than trust. CenturyLink offers cybersecurity solutions to the government. And the Department of Homeland Security has approved CenturyLink to provide enhanced cybersecurity services to critical infrastructure entities to keep you efficient and secure. As your trusted technology partner, their visionary cloud infrastructure, global broadband network, along with custom communication solutions and responsive dedicated support, provide the scalable solutions you need 24/7, 365. Visit CenturyLink.com/gov to learn more.
True innovation means anticipating challenges before they occur. Lockheed Martin was early to recognize the changing nature of naval warfare. New types of threats in coastal waters called for a new kind of combat ship. We responded with deep thinking for shallow waters, designing the littoral combat ship with speed, agility, and the most networked sensors of any surface combatant. And to make sure commanders stay one step ahead of evolving missions, the LCS is built on a flexible C-frame with interchangeable mission modules. It offers the operational flexibility to execute focused missions such as anti-submarine, mine, and surface warfare, providing access and dominance in the coastal battle space like never before. The LCS is one more example of our ongoing commitment to those who are meeting the security challenges of today and tomorrow. Lockheed Martin. We never forget who we're working for.
At BAE Systems, we are turning vast amounts of data into actionable intelligence to stay one step ahead of the bad guys. With our proven activity-based intelligence technology and tradecraft, our experts are helping government agencies predict and prevent illegal and potentially harmful acts. Knowing our work makes a difference inspires us every day. So we'll be there on the next front. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work. Learn more at baesystems.com/nextfront.
I'm John Frieden. Please join me this Saturday at 10 a.m. for Power of Attorney on 1500 AM. This week, my guest will be attorney Charity Price, who will be discussing some of the risks associated with regulating social media usage by employees. Power of Attorney is sponsored by Odin Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Reston, Virginia. For more information about the show, visit us on the web at powerofattorneyradio.com.
Now your Federal News Radio DoD report, brought to you by CenturyLink, afternoons at 37 minutes past the hour. The Defense Science Board has a technology wish list it believes is necessary to maintain global military superiority by 2030. It recommends using a satellite security program modeled after the one protecting submarines. It also has a list of futuristic weapons it would like the Pentagon to develop. Tune in for your DoD report, brought to you by CenturyLink, afternoons at 37 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The most important federal news story of the week is where we are. Alan Power and Ron Sanders choosing the stories on this week's Federal News Countdown. And Alan, your most important story of the week is Jason Miller. Did he like slide you a 10 spot or something to choose two of his stories on the countdown? Okay. And that's fine because this is one countdown where payola is legal. You've chosen Jason's story. DHS and SANS Institute, joined forces to give agencies a cyber primer. It was just an odd coincidence because you're affiliated, I believe, with the SANS Institute.
I felt guilty about that one.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
You did not feel guilty about it one bit.
I was looking for a story on continuous monitoring because it finishes the four-part story we've been telling today. We sort of said, look, the NIST guidance is impossible to implement. So what do you do if you want to protect your systems? And Ron was saying, and compliance jobs are killing people. Well, the compliance jobs are going away. So where do you go? And then we talked about Seoul, where Jane and Tony and others are saying, and Australia in particular, saying, we found out what to do. We need to do it. The problem is it's hard to do it, especially when you don't have a lot of great technical people around. And what I wanted for the third story was something about what John Streufert and the continuous monitoring program was doing, not because it's the right thing to do, but because he changed the economics of it. In general, people won't do something they're uncomfortable with if it costs any money, and they'll use the fact that they don't have any money to not do the thing they're uncomfortable with.
Especially in a budget environment like we have now.
What the White House did was it provided $150 million to kick off a free to federal agency continuous monitoring program. So the agencies don't have to pay for the technology or the consulting. The DHS pays for both. But the question is, what would they focus on? Mm-hmm. And the answer is they're focusing on the same four controls the Australians found and that Jane Holud is pushing and that Tony's pushing. And so it's – and the states now – have figured out that they can buy from this contract too, and DHS has already brought the prices down by over 50% on many of these tools. We expect the prices to drop by 90% before it's done. And the reason is, when everybody doesn't know what to buy, the salesmen are in control. Mm-hmm. They can come running in and saying, you need a new microphone. Your microphone's terrible. And if you don't know the difference, you feel I must need a new microphone. If you know what to buy, then the vendors have to compete on who's doing the known thing best. Mm-hmm. And they both have, and once they get the technical capabilities equalized, then it's all on price. And that's what's happening. What happened with this money that DHS is providing is it's bringing the cost down not only to federal agencies, but to state agencies as well. And I think it'll spread to commercial companies, too.
My colleague Beth Reardon is sending me a message. Let's be clear, your problem is not your microphone. I don't know why that's the case. But Ron, I want to go back to what your number two story, because this has implications for the people part of this equation, right, too. Now that we understand where we're going to go, this is going to make it easier, it seems for me, too, for agencies to identify what their weaknesses are human resources-wise. It's also going to make it easier for institutions, colleges, and other people that are training people to be able to put people in the right places and in the right instruction tracks to be able to succeed, whether it's to come to work for the federal government or to come to work for industry.
Right. I mean, look, there's an ecosystem out there around cyber and cyber skills, and the demand signal, what the work looks like, drives the pipeline from K through 12 through higher education to SANS and other certification programs, et cetera, and that drives both demand in the private sector and in government, including those companies that occupy the borderland between the private sector and government, like Booz Allen. So it's all interrelated. What's happening internationally, nationally, in Washington, in the marketplace, all of that's a demand signal. And of course, my worry has always been human capital generally, but of late, in the last 10 years or so, cyber human capital. And the demand continues to outstrip supply, and the pipeline continues to struggle. The more predictability and stability we can bring to that, the better. Now, I know that you can't bring stability to the cybersecurity threat. It evolves by the minute. But you can bring predictability around the skill sets associated with it. And I think things like the NIST framework, particularly the workforce part of the NIST framework and NICE and what DHS is doing, will really help smooth out the pipeline and make sure that those institutions that contribute to the pipeline know where they need to take students.
Do you agree with his optimism there? That sounds like a fair amount of optimism.
I think we can get pretty clear picture of what we need. What's been missing, it's missing in the NIST framework, actually. I mean, the NICE framework. Is people, this is like medicine. You're going to be a doctor, but you need to know anatomy. Mm-hmm. We've got thousands of people in security who don't know networking, couldn't find a TCP packet if it bit them. They don't know operating systems. They don't know system administration. And that's kind of the anatomy and the chemistry of medicine. So what we've allowed people to do in the compliance era is become security people by being able to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Now we know what the foundations are. That's what the colleges need to teach, is those foundations of cybersecurity.
And we're back to what we talked about before, about your idea about stopping admiring the problem. We've had a generation of admirers, and now we're building a generation of technicians. Am I on the right track?
Janet Napolitano had a great line, too. She was in a meeting with us at a task force on cyber skills, and she said, "We have too many frequent flyers. People who sit in the back of the plane and think they know how to fly the plane. If they went into the cockpit, they'd crash." Mm-hmm. And that's what we've got. We've got a whole bunch of frequent flyers in cybersecurity who will tell everyone else what to do. Mm-hmm. But if they were handed the machine, they couldn't protect it at all. We need to shift that.
And I have to tell you, I was up earlier in the week with our folks and NSA folks and Cyber Command folks. And you couldn't tell the difference amongst them. And what was most impressive, these were all fairly young people, scary smart, just off the charts smart, so smart that all of their leaders had no clue what they were talking about. But it sounded pretty good, so you turn them loose. Just an impressive a bunch of talent up there, and the more that we can develop and reward and retain, the better.
Isn't that nirvana, though, in this, when you have groups like that together and you can't tell the difference who's the contractor and who's the government?
Yeah, that works perfectly. It's very scary when the government guys don't know enough about technology to help guide the contractors, and NSA is one of the few places where the guys on both sides of the table and the women on both sides of the table are scary smart.
Is that trend going in the right direction, though?
No.
Still not yet.
Yeah, they've outsourced their brains in a lot of the agencies.
Are these the kinds of things that will help change that trend, do you think?
I think that if we can standardize on what we need to do, we can lower the threshold for doing security well, and use normal people, not having to create these scary smart people. We just ran a program called Cyber Aces with five governors, and we got 10,000 people signing up for it. We're pretty confident that out of those 10,000, we're going to find about 40 super smart ones. So 10,000 people who think they really know this stuff, and we're looking for 40. It's too hard to find the super, super smart people. We need to make security easier to manage. And I think the work that we talked about in those three stories, deciding what to do, automating it, following the continuous monitoring from DHS will work.
Alan Powler's most important federal news story of the week is Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com. DHS and SANS Institute joined forces to give agencies cyber primer. And all of the stories from this week's countdown will be linked later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, including Ron Sanders' selection for the most important federal news story of the week. It'll wrap up our federal news countdown next on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Lenovo ThinkPad X1 Carbon Touch Ultrabook, inspired by Intel, the world's lightest 14-inch notebook with Intel Core i7 processor and robust security, assembled in America. Learn more at WTOP.com/ultrabook.
Can't make it to every Wizards game this season? Wizards partial plans are on sale now. Purchase a 5, 13, or 21-game plan starting at just $17 per game. Select your own games. Call 202-661-5050 or visit WashingtonWizards.com today.
Here's Chase Garwood, acting CIO, Small Business Administration, Continuous Monitoring, Tools and Techniques for Trustworthy Government IT Panel, sponsored by Tripwire.
Where do I listen to, you know, operational and mission perspective versus security perspective, and where do we make those choices based upon risk? The second part of that is, do I have the skill sets, do I have the tools on an operational or an engineering perspective to tackle that issue?
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Agencies are under immense pressure to implement continuous monitoring to improve their cybersecurity performance. Tripwire understands cyber threats and vulnerabilities, federal initiatives, and compliance standards. That's why agencies using Tripwire's foundational security controls typically achieve over 80% risk reduction in under 6 quarters. Leading federal agencies and nearly half of the Fortune 500 depend on Tripwire. Find out why at tripwire.com.
Here's Rear Admiral Robert Day, CIO, U.S. Coast Guard, on the Federal Executive Forum on Data Center Consolidation, sponsored by HP.
As an operator on the front lines, and I need a new capability, I'm basically going to be able to go to an enterprise catalog and say, I need this, I need it now, and I only need it for these 10 days. And literally, it's going to be no different than me going on to the Internet now saying, I want a Google Plus account, I want this much storage in the cloud, and those types of capabilities.
To listen to the whole program, made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to FederalNewsRadio.com. Is your IT organization struggling with an outmoded data center that's ill-equipped to accommodate today's converged high-density IT infrastructures? If so, HP's data center transformation experts can work with you to analyze all of your options and help you select the solution that's right for you. From renovation to new construction, public, private, and hybrid cloud, co-location, and outsourcing, they're ready to help you throughout your journey of IT and facilities transformation to a future state that's more cost and energy efficient. To learn more, visit hp.com/go/federal.
This week's Health IT Solution Report brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The bar to enroll people in health insurance exchanges for the month of October is set at 500,000 people. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has monthly goals set until the end of March of 2014. That's when the open enrollment period is over. But computer and access problems with the exchange websites might undermine the hopes of reaching that initial goal of 500,000. Despite the problems, the HHS still expects to sign up about 496,000 people by the end of October. That's 4,000 people short of the goal. The agency expects more than 3 million people to be connected with the exchanges by the end of 2013. By the end of March of 2014, HHS expects that total enrollment number to balloon beyond 7 million people.
General Dynamics Information Technology Health IT Services and Solutions. Improving health outcomes through the power of IT. General Dynamics IT. To learn more, go to gdit.com/health.
A new pilot program from the U.S. Postal Service promises citizens the ability to access everything from federal health benefits to student loan information with just one ID and password. Using a cloud service hub, agencies will be able to accept citizen credentials. This will also change authentication and access procedures. Join FC of Bethesda November 7th at the Bethesda North Marriott as federal leaders discuss challenges faced by agencies as they transition to the next generation of identity and access management. Register today at fcofbethesda.org/NOVbreakfast.
Some stories are best told through pictures. Check out our Fed Photos of the Day gallery for a different perspective on the federal community. Find it on our homepage, federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week with the three most important stories of the week is selected by Alan Power and Ron Sanders, and we have one left. Ron, your most important story of the week is from the Federal Times, and it's headlined, "Now the Hard Part, Undoing the Mess Wrought by a 16-Day Shutdown." And this is a topic that we've covered a lot on this station, but this piece from Sean Riley, I think, gets a lot of voices about how this will work and what it will be like to try to recover. I mean, this is a recovery operation. And I think maybe some people in at the managerial level are just starting to understand that, having been back to work for a week or 10 days now.
Right. We need to stop looking in the rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we've got the good news that we started with. The employment brand still works. There's still lots of people, not just people looking for security, but talented people who want to make a difference, who still want to work for government. But we're also hemorrhaging critical skills at the margin where, frankly, it makes the most difference. So how do we work our way out of this? I think you have to approach this on three levels, and I'll do this sort of from the bottom up. I think everybody knows, there's lots of research to back this up, Francis. The go or stay decision that employees make is based primarily on the relationship they have with their immediate manager. That relationship is positive, they'll overlook a lot. If it's negative, their tolerance limits go way down and they vote with their feet. And again, critical skills like cyber, they have the opportunity to vote with their feet, and that's where we should be losing the most sleep. So individual managers need to worry about the care and feeding of their employees. And whine, W-H-I-N-E.
You're not a whiner. That's surprising coming from you.
I've seen agencies disinvest in leader development from bottom to top over the course of the last year and then some. There are some exceptions to that, and they deserve lots of credit because this is the easiest thing to cut. The ROI is so squishy. But we pick our frontline managers based on their technical skills, not their ability to lead and manage. This is when they need to be able to lead and manage. Agency heads, I like what I've been seeing in the paper, welcoming employees back. That's a great thing. But I also think it's going to take agency leaders to get the workforce refocused on mission. Not just individual managers reminding them why they're there, but the really big, hairy, audacious goals that every agency has, the big challenges. Get them mobilized and oriented and focused on that. That's a senior leader responsibility. And I think we ought to, again, quit looking in the rearview mirror, set the target over the horizon and move towards it. Now, lastly, and a lot of that's happening, lastly, what I've been waiting for is the enterprise response, the government-wide response. I think the other two stories I chose suggest that we can no longer survive with a one-size-fits-all system. There are some jobs that got people lined up around the block. There are other jobs where they're leaving in droves. And a civil service system says you're all alike, that focuses on fairness rather than performance, I think is problematic. So there are lots of things you can do under current law to focus on those critical skills and really nurture them. You know, because I've been saying this for two decades, there are some things we need to do to change that law, but we've got to start attacking it from a strategic standpoint. And I know the president has organized these working groups around a new president's management agenda. The sooner we unveil that and get started implementing it, the better.
He does have all the people in place that he needs to do that now. For a long time, one of the challenges there was he didn't have a full component or a full complement of leaders at the Office of Management and Budget to do it. Now he has those people. So
he does it at OMB.
That's a step in the right direction.
He does it at OMB, but a significant portion of the President's Management Council, the deputy secretaries, the COOs, are actings.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we're still waiting for confirmation from our next OPM director. So, yeah, the pieces are falling into place gradually. What we need to do whatever we need to do to get the rest of the pieces in place and then charge.
From the outside looking in, Alan, what does the federal shutdown, the government shutdown, mean for the areas that you care about the most?
That came up a lot of times during the shutdown. One of the most interesting things is it isolated the people who actually had the critical jobs, because you kept people on who were really protecting your systems, mm-hmm. and you sent home the people who were admiring the problem.
Uh-huh.
So it was one of the few times that you got a really clear picture of who mattered. There's another thing going on, though, and I kind of want to ask Ron about it. Is there any movement in the shortage to move toward doing less? And I'll give you an example. In the aftermath of the Snowden affair, there's been a huge shift from hiring hundreds and hundreds of system administrators for every system to centralizing system administration. Turns out that's a brilliant idea. And it means we don't have to pay as much for this clerical job of system administration. That makes a lot of sense to me. We can do that across the board in IT, but because we chop it up contractor by contractor, the contractors don't seem to like it. Is there any movement across government to get toward efficiency?
Well, I don't think it's limited to IT. We did a report with the Partnership for Public Service a few months ago called Building the Enterprise. And basically the premise was and is that in most cases, the federal government's a confederation of agencies, stovepipes, cylinders of excellence. And in only rare cases does it act as an enterprise where it leverages for both efficiency and effectiveness this notion of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So IT is one of those places that we singled out where an enterprise approach would make sense. You're talking about the structure of jobs in the enterprise, frankly, the whole architecture. How many clouds do we need? Same thing with acquisition, strategic sourcing. Strategic sourcing at the government level, harnessing the buying power of all agencies, not just a few, can be off the charts powerful. Same thing with human capital. We've talked a lot about that. So maybe the silver lining of sequestration and the budget cuts is that it's going to force agencies to do transformational things like that, not just do the salami slice cuts. One of the things that I'm most concerned about as sequestration, you know, it is a salami slice. It's across the board. But agencies still have some discretion. I hope Congress gives agencies even more to take the budget cuts, but then rationalize how they're taking them. Look for those efficiencies. Look for those places where they can do it with fewer resources, but in some cases, no worse. In many cases, maybe even better.
Yeah.
That's the silver lining that I hope agencies take advantage of, whether it's sequestration or some other formula. We know budget cuts are coming.
Mm-hmm.
So let us leverage them to transform agencies.
I've been shocked, especially given some of the highly technical things that we've talked about on this program today, that we haven't seen any movement on the administration side to come and say, all right, we recognize this is going to happen, and here's the list of the things that we're going to have to do. You talked about doing less, and I've been surprised that that hasn't been the case. I mean, the president's budget request for the Pentagon, the place where this is talked about the most, was way above Budget Control Act number. It's like they didn't even think it was going to happen, like they figured it was just going to disappear or something.
Well, you know the way the budget game is played, mm-hmm. and it's played at every level.
Yeah.
From the first line manager to our institutions, you put the things that are most important to everybody on the table for budget cuts because you know that they'll be hard to cut. And the net result is you make lurching incremental progress towards actually absorbing those cuts and dealing with them, as opposed to stepping back and as objectively as humanly possible saying, these are things we need to stop doing. These are things we need to do better. These are the places we're going to invest more in because it's critical to our economic or national security. But that's being very Pollyannish. I'll admit that on a Friday.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Ron Sanders. It is from the Federal Times. It's headline, "Now the Hard Part, Undoing the Mess Wrought by a 16-Day Shutdown." And all of the stories that we talked about on this week's Federal News Countdown are archived later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And, Alan, I'm going to make you very jealous as we wrap up the countdown.
You got a book.
Look at this. Look at this. This book is called Tackling Wicked Government Problems, and it is by Jackson Nickerson, who's been on this program talking about this book, and one Ron Sanders, who you may have heard of before.
The Ron Sanders.
Yeah, or the one that's right over here, sitting right across the table from us. Congratulations on this. We've talked about this on the radio, but I'm pleased to receive a copy of this, and it's he inscribed it very kindly. It says, "To Francis, I don't know why I keep doing this, Ron Sanders."
That's not what I said.
It's terrific. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here. It's been great to have you on the countdown. The